Ahead and turn things over to Kate Garufi, who will provide an introduction to today's talk. And again, I apologize for that brief delay, but Kate, whenever you're ready, please feel free to get started.
Thank you so much, Jean, and I want to echo Jean's opening remarks and welcome everybody to this Cluin seminar. So before we get started on the technical program content, I wanted to give folks on the webinar an introduction to the EPA and Society of American Military Engineers, or SAME, collaboration. The collaboration is called Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites. The objective of this collaboration between EPA and SAME is really one of facilitation and communication. Design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites are pretty niche, and the objectives of our collaboration is to have in-person and virtual learning and communication events where we can share information among professionals from both the private sector and the public sector regarding design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites, methods, lessons learned, applications of technologies. It provides a variety of forums for presentations describing current practices and approaches in those areas, as I just identified, management techniques, case studies, field experiences in designing construction issues. It also enhances communication networks and promotes continued discussion among professionals. So as I mentioned before, the collaboration has a number of events. We have two in-person symposiums. Hopefully by the end of this year, we'll get back to in-person symposiums. We have an e-symposium, which is traditionally held in person in Philadelphia. This year, it is going to be held virtual. It will be March 29th, 31st, and April 1st. It will be held on the Cluin platform that we're using today in a similar format. And we are putting the agenda together right now, and the registration will be open shortly, and we will be communicating that through TechDirect, Cluin, and other forums. In addition to our East Symposium, we also have a West Symposium that's typically held in Denver. Due to the current COVID situation, we're still looking at different opportunities, whether we're going to do it virtually or in person, but we will keep you updated on future webinar events as to the delivery format and the dates for that. In addition to these in-person symposiums, like this presentation today, we have a DCHWS seminar series, which includes webinars and, in the future, some in-person training on technical areas such as construction management. So in the context of the seminar series, of which this is one of seven planned for fiscal year 2021, we have deliveries every other month, so January, March, May, July, and September of 2021. As I mentioned before, we also have an in-person training for construction management that we're working on. We have a website for DCHWS. You can see it at the bottom of this slide, dchws.org. We have up-to-date information not only on the seminar series, but also our in-person events. So I suggest that you visit that site, bookmark it, and keep it on your bookmarks to get the most up-to-date information and links for registration and items like that. Our upcoming webinar in this series, in addition to today, the next one is in March, and this is the information for the March webinar. The registration is open. The link is at the bottom of the slide. So if you'd like to learn about a cold case detective story for a soil cover at a landfill, I encourage you to go onto our Cluin website and register for that event in 2 months. So getting to our presentation today, we have four presenters from HDR and EPA Region 2, and I'd like to introduce them briefly before turning it over to Patty. So our first presenter is Patricia Parvis. Patricia, or Patty, is a vice president, professional associate, and senior project manager at HDR with over 26 years of experience specializing in managing large remedial investigation feasibility studies, remedial design, remedial action, and operation and maintenance projects for federal and state Superfund programs in New Jersey and New York. She is well-versed in both New Jersey and New York site remediation regulatory programs and is also proficient in obtaining federal and state permits in support of remedial actions at sites with ecological resources. She has collaborated on the design and managed construction of an industry-first sediment cap having no permanent or temporary impacts to riparian resources. She has experience using forensic analyses such as 3D CSIA to distinguish between chlorinated solvent sources and commingled groundwater plumes. Her presentations focus on non-traditional investigation and remediation technologies such as preserving environmentally sensitive natural resources during remedial actions at the May 2018 USAID SAME Joint Engineer Training Conference. So we welcome Patty. In addition to Patty from HDR, we also have Andrew Wadden. Andrew Wadden is a licensed site remediation professional and project manager at HDR with over 15 years of experience in the environmental consulting industry. Andrew has an MS in environmental studies from the University of Massachusetts Lowell and a BS in chemistry from Fairfield University. He's been working on the Conesville South landfill, the subject of this presentation, since 2010 with the OU2 remedial investigation phase and continued involvement through the preliminary design investigation and RD phases of work. So welcome, Andrew. In addition to Andrew Wadden, we also have Andy Watson from HDR. Andy is a licensed professional engineer and project manager at HDR. He has over 12 years of experience in the environmental consulting industry, supporting remedial investigations, remedial designs and implementations, and remedial process optimization projects. Mr. Watson has an MS in environmental engineering from the New Jersey Institute of Technology and a BS in environmental systems engineering from Penn State. So welcome to Andrew and Andy. In addition, we also have Pamela Baxter. Pamela Baxter is a PhD, CHMM, and is an environmental engineer for the US EPA's Region 2 Superfund Emergency Management Division. She has been there for over 30 years. Her experience has been working as a remedial project manager by managing various New Jersey Superfund hazardous waste sites from the remedial investigation phase to construction activities to post-construction activities. She is a certified hazardous materials manager, member of the Institute of Hazardous Material Management, and a member of Alliance of Hazardous Material Professionals. Pamela earned her Bachelor of Engineering of Mechanical Engineering from the City University of New York and has earned three Masters of Science degrees in Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences, Environmental Engineering, and Construction Management. In addition, she received her PhD degree in Civil Engineering from Stevens Institute of Technology. She is currently an adjunct assistant professor at the City College of the City University of New York. So welcome to our four presenters, and we're really looking forward to hearing your technical content today. So without further ado, I now turn it over to Patty Parvis to get us started with the technical content of our presentation. Thanks, Patty.
So this is the title of our presentation, Conesville South Superfund Site, 40 years to the finish.
And Patty, please remember to request control so you can move through your slides.
The 20th century. It was a dark time in history when humans were wasteful and lazy and decided to deface nature with remnants of their daily lives. They poured those remnants into the earth at previously lovely places, creating giant monuments to their waste. Then they spent decades trying to repair their mistakes. This effort continues to this day, and that is what our story is about.
So welcome, everybody. We were having a little problems with that animation. We're great at home. Anyway, glad that you're here. I'm going to take you through a long journey, an amazing journey. There are many detours along the way of this journey. There are also many attempts with good intentions to cure the problems. However, there are also many corrosive forces at play. This is our site. This is the Conesville South Superfund site in Chester, New Jersey. It's located in both Washington and Chester townships. And as you can see from the topographic map, it's in an area with pretty considerable topographic relief. The bedrock geology is a key player in our story. It is all metamorphic rock, and if you note, there's gneiss, there's granite, there's alaskite. And the bedrock is in narrow bands running from southwest to northeast, and that drives a lot of our story today. So witness the birth of a landfill. This is how the landfill grew and spread over time. It was almost half a century of uncontrolled, largely unregulated landfilling. And it was mostly invisible to the surrounding neighborhood until the trout streams turned from clear to orange and red, and 100 acres of forested wetlands were almost destroyed. But let's go back to the beginning. So this is the site in the 1930s. Of course, it was very rural at the time, as was most of that area in New Jersey, and the site was all in agriculture. Stories go that the landfill opened sometime in the 1940s, although we don't know exactly when. It accepted household waste, sewage sludge, septic tank waste, industrial waste, chemicals, and waste oil. By 1970, the landfilling was very predominant, and the method they used, they would remove the soil and overburden down to the bedrock surface, and they would stockpile that material off to the side to later use as daily cover. The trenches they dug were as large as 400 feet long by 20 feet wide and 20 feet deep, and these were trenches open with the bottom being fractured rock. They placed the refuse that the landfill collected directly on top of the fractured rock at the bottom of the trenches, and this allowed leachate and stormwater runoff to enter the near vertical bedrock fractures. Sometime in the early 70s, it had a name. By then it was known as the Filiberto Landfill, and the only reason being is that the local Filiberto family, who owned the former agricultural lands, had turned this into a landfill. However, by 1972, this was a significant year. This was the first year of regulatory oversight. The name had changed from Filiberto Landfill to Chester Hills Landfill. And at this time, the state had approved the trench method of waste disposal. Also at this time, the operator wanted to expand landfilling to the southwest and starting to encroach on the forested wetlands. And the New Jersey Department of Fish and Game observed what they called, and this is their term, landfill juices moving to the local streams. Now, in 1978, the year before this aerial photograph, the Combfill Corporation had purchased the property from the current owner at the time. And as you can see, Combfill had the landfill in full-blown operation. A lot of bad things started happening. A lot of leachate seeps were emerging from the western and southwestern portions of the landfill. And unfortunately, the leachate was emptying into the streams and discoloring them. And even though they had installed a leachate collection sump, it hadn't worked too well. So as I said, in 72, that's when the first certificate to operate was issued, and it was for non-hazardous and municipal solid waste. 73 was when the first fish kill started happening in local Trout Brook, and the first leachate collection and recycling system was installed, which never worked or didn't work very well. And then 1974 was the first year wells were installed. I think the state requested 4 monitoring wells at that time. By 77, additional monitoring wells had gone in. We all know what that's like as consultants. 78 was when the Combfill Corporation purchased the site. And 79 was the first time outside inspectors observed the stormwater runoff and leachate directly entering bedrock fractures. And interesting to note, which will come into play later in our presentation, in 1981, Combfill Corp itself reported that they had accepted pharmaceutical waste. This was a sketch by someone who went out there in 1979 to do an inspection. What I found really interesting about this sketch was not the landfill itself, but the two farm fields to the northwest of the landfill. As you can see, this inspector said high and dry. And the reason that's important is because that's where the local groundwater recharge is. And it's high and dry directly above the landfill and directly above the headwaters of trout streams. This is particularly problematic. So in 1981, that's when Combfill in earnest started clearing the forested wetlands to the west. They wanted to landfill an additional 100 acres, which would have been a true environmental disaster, more so than it even is. By March of the same year, both municipalities filed suit, and a judge issued a temporary order for 2 weeks to halt landfilling. Then the locals really started to get involved. In April of that year, the Upper Raritan Watershed Association did their own sampling of monitoring wells and surface water. And then the local residents from Chester and Washington townships formed a citizens group called HALT, Help Stop a Landfill Tragedy, and they sampled their own 90 potable wells surrounding the landfill. September of the same year, the state issued an order to stop landfilling because this data that the state and the local residents had gathered indicated that there was groundwater contamination emanating from the landfill. So, of course, what happens after that? Well, we begin the remedial investigation. So the first RI began in 1983. And this is what the landfill looked like at the beginning of the 1983 to 1985 RIFS. As you can see, lots of seeps, loud gurgling ones, so they were very active. The landfill wasn't even really stabilized property. You had empty garbage, loose drums flying around, and an abandoned shop area with tanks. And you can see that they had installed the old leachate collection sump directly at the headwaters of the East Branch of Trout Brook. To the White House. So what had happened at that time, you know, the residents found out that their potable wells were contaminated, which is obviously never a good thing. So a local attorney was so concerned about his well being contaminated that he wrote to President Ronald Reagan in the White House and asked that he please do everything that can be done to expedite the installation of an alternate water supply for the residents. They had been promised that in 1986, but we will learn later that it took much longer than that. So by 1987, the original RIFS had been completed. There was also a conceptual design that had been completed at that time. So by this point in time, the landfill was idle, nothing was happening, and the final remedial design was being worked on. This was the design that would ultimately go out to bid and be constructed. So the existing landfill cap was constructed in the mid-1990s. This photograph, you can see that the grading and some of the stormwater drainage had been constructed, but this was before the final cap had been completed. The groundwater treatment plant had been constructed but wasn't online yet, and you can actually see some of the construction trailers in the staging area to the right. So the landfill was capped and completed, and the treatment plant was turned on by 1997. But 9 years later, something started happening at the northernmost portion of the site, which you can see at the central upper portion of the slide. There had been some disturbance outside the perimeter road, and we're going to talk about that a little later. And in 2007, that area had been stabilized, and the landfill cap extension was being designed and was actually completed the following year. So let's talk a little bit about the groundwater data, because that's what we're probably all interested in. So that high and dry area on the inspector's map from the late 70s, that was location S6, which is just below the title of the slide. And you can see the total VOCs there were very low. The total VOCs were 7 parts per billion. However, where those leachate seeps were entering the trout stream at the lower left corner of the map, location S1, the VOCs were highest at over 1,500. Now, the problem in the 1980s, and I guess we'll say that 30 years from now when we look back on the 2020s, but the problem was, you know, the priority pollutant list was very short at the time. I don't know, it's 5, 6, 7 times longer at this point in time. So we are looking for a much more limited suite of contaminants. The detection limits that the laboratories could achieve at the time were much higher. So, for example, vinyl chloride, which currently has a groundwater standard of 1, the lab reported it below the method detection limit at 10. So we really couldn't see very well either. And also at this time, the contaminants of concern themselves were different than our present-day contaminants of concern. This is just another challenge and something that takes 40 years. So benzene is still a contaminant of concern, but contaminants such as toluene, which is completely absent now, chloroethane, methylene chloride, those are no longer around. The deep well data was very similar at the time. Now, I have to caution you, this is not really bedrock well data. This is more likely deeper overburden data because this was the overburden aquifer. But you can see that high and dry farm field, the total VOCs were 0. And at the southwest corner, they were highest near the trout stream at almost 1,300. But with the deeper well data, they started investigating to the northeast. And that turned out to be another very predominant area on the site. And the VOCs are relatively high. The furthest well off site, D2, in the upper right-hand corner, the VOCs were over 400. And of course, the deep well data was pretty much the same as the shallow well data. And of course, with the same limited contaminant list and the same high detection limits. So lots of detours happened. And one of the fun and exciting detours was the discovery of buried drums. Now, yes, it is a landfill, but it was not thought that there were extensive buried drums anywhere. So while they were mobilizing to the site to construct the cap and before they had started construction, they found a whole bunch of buried drums along the northern portion of the landfill. And this particular image is of the state geologist's map that he carried with him into the field each day as the drums were being removed. So they were quite a lot of them, and they thought they had removed them, and that was that. My favorite story from the state geologist, I just love this one, is that one day he was out in the field and he heard glass breaking, which is not something you expect to hear working on a landfill. And then he smelled a very familiar but strange odor, and it was a drum of Aqua Velva bottles from the 1970s. So I don't know how many other Superfund sites are contaminated with Aqua Velva, but this is probably the only one. And the Aqua Velva is key here, and it is a prelude of things to come in our story. The other things that happened, the other detours, were people outside of the agencies and the people trying to address this did some stupid things. There was a residential developer who brilliantly decided to construct a single-family home residential subdivision down gradient and directly adjacent to the landfill. And outside of the cul-de-sac road that the developer installed, brilliantly, he decided to install all the potable wells for the future single-family homes in one shot, first. Not one, didn't sample, didn't do anything, just installed 15 wells. And unfortunately, what this ended up doing is it provided a freeway for the contaminants in the overburden aquifer to jump directly down to 700 feet below grade and act as these uncontrolled vertical conduits that didn't previously exist. Now, what this figure is probably the only good thing that came out of this Millstone Crossing development. The New Jersey Geological Survey mobilized to that site, and they were able to use these now abandoned and never to be used potable wells to do some geophysical investigations downhole. Here we go. Sorry, it wasn't advancing. So the New Jersey Geological Survey issued a report in 2004, the hydrogeological interpretation of these potable wells, primarily optical televiewer downhole, but they also used some other downhole techniques. The the overall findings of this turned out to be very valuable. So they were the first to define a portion of the plume. They defined the northeastern plume. And as you can see, we talked about the bedrock in one of the, I think, the second slide. But the plume sits between two bedrock highs. So essentially, the plume sits in a valley between two aquitards formed by the bedrock highs. And so this has been a very valuable study, and the results are still true and accurate today. So going back to that thing we saw in the 2006 aerial, it was actually something that was discovered by the state. They were doing some routine landfill gas monitoring, installing soil probes around the outside of the landfill cap. And they found some grainy material that smelled bad and sampled it, and it was high in benzene. So then they did a little bit of a test pit investigation from 2003 to 2004 and found all sorts of waste outside of the landfill cap. This obviously was a problem. This area became known as the North Waste Cell, and it was never apparent from any site history that anyone was aware of. It really wasn't distinguishable on aerial photographs between the other waste. It was close to the previously buried drums in the mid-90s, but the state had gone outside of those buried drums until they got to native material in the woods. So they thought that there wasn't anything beyond that area. And in terms of when this originally occurred, there were some clues. They found a 1966 New York Times in the excavation. So the remedial action was dig and haul. Started in June of 2006, you know, consisting of your typical excavation, characterization of the excavated waste and off-site disposal. It was a little bit over 27,000 tons, and this excavation was super deep. I think it was 30 feet, possibly more in some spots. And so what they had to do was they had to continuously backfill as they were excavating. And you can see the backfill they used in the left foreground. And then they designed and extended the cap and completed construction of the extended cap in 2008. And I should mention that, you know, all the state's post-ex samples were clean at the time, and all the waste had been removed. Unfortunately, because of the underlying bedrock geology with the near vertical fractures and the waste having been in there since the 60s, at least according to the newspaper, the contamination had already made its way into groundwater decades earlier. The Northwest Waste Cell is just so interesting. Some of what we've learned is that there were literally warehouses of off-spec personal care products. And this is what resulted in our currently primary contaminant of concern we're going to talk about later today. Another one of my favorite stories is the Baby Magic Baby Lotion. So in the early 70s, there were about 15 deaths in the U.S. and in Europe because of the hexachlorophene concentrations in Baby Magic Baby Lotion. So after it was banned in 1972, the manufacturers had to get rid of the old stuff they could no longer sell. So that ended up in the North Waste Cell. Another North Waste Cell favorite is Menin shaving cream. It's found in a lot of backhoe buckets and tons of over-the-counter medications. For those who are old enough, you'll recognize things like Sinex and Bromo Seltzer. There were throat sprays and cough syrups. There are also things outside of pharmaceuticals and personal care products. They did find things like a box of cyanide. Cyanide's never been a contaminant of concern, fortunately. What were contaminants of concern, which were chlorofluorocarbons, drums of them were found in the North Waste Cell. When we started the second RI, which was in 2011, they were contaminants of concern, but currently the chlorofluorocarbons are all below the current groundwater quality standards. Although the North Waste Cell was a Herculean effort, which Pam's going to talk about later, identifying those responsible, for the most part, was relatively easy because they came packaged with nice names, addresses, and shipping labels. And most of the PRPs were the local Morris County, New Jersey pharmaceutical companies. One of the more concerning things in the North Way cell were these pharmaceuticals. Not just pharmaceuticals, but experimental pharmaceuticals. Lots of barbiturates. You have experimental sedative number W2062-3. Also lots of phenobarbital. The phenobarbital was a major component in the Tedril children's asthma medication from that time period. And we would find phenobarbital and butobarbital as SDOC ticks in lots of monitoring well samples, and we still find phenobarbital in a lot of monitoring well samples as a tick. And another one of the most interesting photographs to me is the one at the lower right. That's a backhoe bucket with a plastic bag full of red pills, and we have no idea what's in those red pills, and I don't think we'll ever know. Another one of my favorites was experimental chemical number 993. Remember, these were, you know, the big pharma Northern New Jersey companies that are always doing research. So a lot of that research waste ended up in the waste cell. Hydrocyanic acid, a little bit to be concerned about. But that was pretty much the story and makeup of the North waste cell. So we truly believe that when 1,4-dioxane made its appearance from the North waste cell, it also had to coincide with the laboratories finally being able to detect it at lower levels. What makes our 1,4-dioxane unique? Usually it's found as a solvent stabilizer with 111 TCA. Well, in our case, the 1,4-dioxane is more likely to be from the men in shave cream. The waste cell is also a source of phenobarbital, which is not your typical Superfund site contaminant. It was a source of chlorofluorocarbons that appear to have degraded at this point in time. And there's still the issue of the future. I mean, even though we report 30 ticks, who knows what else is out there, maybe even in parts per trillion that we may never know about. And now that I've introduced you to Combfield South, I'm going to turn it over to Pamela Baxter, who's been the RPM for EPA for a really long time. Pam?
Thank you, Patty. Appreciate that for giving us a very nice overview of site history. So now I'm going to go over regulatory history of what the EPA and the state of New Jersey has done for the last several years. Oops. Okay, so I'm going to go into our timeline. So the site was placed on the national priority list back in September 1983, and for a site to be placed on the list, it goes through this extensive hazardous ranking scoring system. And if the score comes out to 28 or higher, it's placed on the Superfund list or the MPL. So in this case, for Combs South, the score was 49, so it was placed on the site. So since that time, from 1984 to 1985, renewal investigation feasibility study was conducted by the state of New Jersey. So Patty just went over all the history of what was found, the contaminants of concern, et cetera. So I just want to say that this is a state lead site. So back at the time in the 80s, under the Reagan administration, they wanted the hazardous waste sites to be cleaned up or handled by the state. So a lot of sites that had logs that were signed in 1986 were state lead sites, and now that has changed over time. But the mechanism for that to happen was through a cooperative agreement between EPA and the state of New Jersey. So there was an agreement. EPA did fund the RFS activities and eventually some of the design and construction activities, as Patty had just described. So I keep going in the wrong direction, I'm sorry. So we had, the state had prepared a design report which was finalized in 1993, and then construction activities started January 1993. Now, you might see the dates are a little bit off, but the contractor was awarded the contract back in 1992. They probably had to maybe tweak the design, and it was probably finalized right before they started construction. Unfortunately, this is where a lot of things started to kind of start off on a bad foot. At the time, the contractor wanted to be identified and the subcontractors, and there was a lot of, going back, looking to the files, there was a lot of correspondence about being identified, and then at this time, EPA's policy on identification was changing. So the contractor wasn't really happy with that, and they delayed their start. They were supposed to start January 93, but they really didn't start until like 6 months later. And they would, so it seems like there was a little bit of bad blood from the get-go. They did do work, but there were some stop-and-go periods. And toward the end, right before they achieved substantial completion, they walked off the job. There were some issues about the drums that Patty talked about, where there was a lot of drums were discovered. And so they walked off the job, but fortunately they had a resident engineer there that was able to finish up. So it was finished in September 97. Unfortunately, there was about over 800 days of delay, which is like 2.5 years of delay, but it was done. But then the sad part is that the first contractor did sue the state of New Jersey for about $64 million. But the good part is they only got a very small fraction of that amount of money. So it's just things sort of like, I guess you want to call it a lesson learned to try to get along, to try to resolve some of the stuff before it happens. But sometimes you really just can't control that. But the site was done, and this is a picture of in action where they are constructing the treatment facility at the landfill. And so that was all said and done. So in 1997 is actually when I received the site. EPA was going through a reorganization. Sites were being changed around. Sections and branches were being combined or separated. And I received that along with Combe North, which is 8 miles from Combe South. And their only similarity is that they both have the same owners. The Filiberto brothers own both properties. So when I received the site, I thought, oh, this is just a simple O&M site. Well, I was wrong. There's a lot of things going on with this site. And what makes this site more, makes it unique is that of all the work that we've done in for such a long time, to date, we do not have a construction completion of the site. But we will get there. But this is sort of probably one of the few sites that would have a 1986 rod and not have construction complete. So this is why this has just been a long, arduous process. So in 2009, well, at least before then, the state was working on doing the deep water aquifer study, which was the component of the rod, which I'll go into. However, because of mechanism, the contract mechanism differences between EPA and the state, EPA took over our FS activities for the deep water aquifer study. For example, during one of our talks with the state, we had asked if they can do directional, requesting their contract to do directional drilling. And they said they weren't able to make that specific request in their contract. So EPA decided, because our contract mechanism is more flexible, that we would just take over and then we can do the activities easier than the state would be able to do that. So that's when we took over. And then in June, after everything's all said and done with the OD1 work, the state had issued the closeout report for OU1. Okay, so the rod, the 1986 rod, the components consisted of doing the alternate water supply, landfill capping, doing the landfill gas collection, pump and treat, site security, you know, basic stuff. And during the construction of the remedy, the state, when they did the numbers, they decided that they didn't need an active gas collection system, and they put in a more passive one for the landfill gas. So I had to do an ESD back in 2006 to do that. And at the time when I was doing this ESD, because we have to do one when you change out a component of the rod, I was actually going to do one for the water line, but it's a good thing I didn't, because I will go into later why that wasn't why it was a good thing I didn't do that. So enforcement, somebody has to pay for this work. It's always a nice thing if we can identify PRPs before we get started, but that's not always a luxury. So of course, as we're doing the work, our legal team is doing their work to find out who's responsible. And as Patty mentioned, we have all these nice looking labels on the trash, so it wasn't hard to find out who was responsible for what. So initially, in 1985, you know, EPA had filed an application bankruptcy court seeking reimbursement and Superfund monies. The Chesterfield Corporation, they reached a settlement for $50,000 with the EPA because they were bankrupt at the time. And then in 2005, we did an initial settlement with the Filibertos, with the owners and operators that paid the state and EPA about $12.5 million in costs. So now we get into the big settlement, which was settled in 2009. And this is where I refer to this as the blood, sweat, and tears settlement. You know, to be doing this for 11 years is really something else. I got to admit, not my favorite thing to do, but something that has to be done. So EPA, you know, we identified some PRPs. Usually it's not the government's mission to go after, you know, regular people because we know they don't have millions of dollars to pay for cleanups. So we like to go after what we call deep pockets. However, the main PRPs that we identify, they can go after smaller pockets, smaller people, and they did. So, you know, I remember in a few meetings they had mentioned that, oh, yeah, we went after the Boy Scouts. We went after a senior citizen home. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's pretty interesting. And I remember in one meeting I was sitting next to a woman, and she said she represented the post office. So I said, well, what did the post office do? And she's like, oh, they found some letterhead or something from the post office. So just, you know, FYI that your trash is your trash. If people find it and part of a lawsuit, they can go after you. So, you know, the PRPs, they had some kind of system where I guess depending on how much trash or what kind of contaminant, if it was contaminant or not, they had their little spreadsheet of who was going to contribute to what. So there was 300 private parties and municipalities, including Chester Township and the borough of Chester, that were responsible for contributing. And at the time, we received, EPA received $69 million in past costs, which at the time would have represented about maybe 70% of all our total costs. And then $3.2 million was paid to the state for natural resource damages. And the state of New Jersey received a $20 million annuity payment, which means they get $900,000 a year, assuming 30 years for O&M, to do O&M and future work at the site. So that's a nice little chunk of change, which has helped us with all the investigations and studies that we have been doing and will be able to pay for the work that we'll be doing in the next year or two. So now I'm going to go into the water supply system. As I mentioned in when I talked about the rod components, there was an alternate water supply. So back in 2008, 1,4-dioxane, the methodology had changed. So we're starting to see more 1,4-dioxane coming up into our samples. And it was decided that EPA would take over the water line. But before we took over the water line activities, you know, back then when we were looking at the rod component, there were studies that were done. Culverts were placed in homes, 32 homes in the early 90s. as an interim measure pending the design of the construction of the water supply. The state has signed a third-party contract with the Washington Town Municipality for the design of the waterline project, and the cost of that was about $11 million to service about 325 residences. Back in 95, EPA had suspended the waterline construction to do more additional tests, and they found out that the concentrations weren't that high to support or justify spending $11 million for this. So the waterline supply system was suspended. And then, as I just said, the discovery of morphodioxane in domestic water in 2008, especially in the Poet system, had reopened the need to put in this waterline. So again, EPA took over waterline activities from the state in 2010. And then since this time, we have done, we started with doing a comprehensive study, sampling all the residences' wells. We did design, we had to do permitting activities. So the one thing I do want to mention on the permitting is that the Highlands Council is a council that it's a regional planning agency that works in partnership with municipalities and counties in the Highlands region, and they have the 2004 Highlands Water Protection Act and is charged with the creation and adoption of a regional master plan to protect and enhance the natural resources within the New Jersey Highlands. So when you talk about a water line in the Highlands area, they don't like that because, you know, this is a rural area, and it's always, I guess the notion is that if you start putting water lines, then you're going to have developers coming in with these massive development plans. So, but what saved us was the fact that we had a public health crisis. So we did get approval, but the process was very lengthy, but we were able to get approval to put in this water line. So activities had started, it took about 2 years, and it was completed in July 2015, and the cost was about $9 million. So this is in 2011 when we did the comprehensive well sampling activities. So at the time, the MCLs was about 3 parts per million. And so you can see that in the red areas, it was greater than 3. And the blues was non-detect, and the yellow areas was less than 3. Now we're using New Jersey numbers, and it's 0.4. Okay, so at the same time that we were doing, EPA was doing the waterline activities, we also did a bench scale or a treatability study for something for the poets that the homeowners had. And so it was in 3 phases. We did a bench scale study, we did a pellet test, and we did a pellet test for the landfill for the treatment facility. So for the homes that had the poets, we only had one homeowner that agreed to do it, because the other homeowners were afraid that if we put this system in, that they weren't going to be connected to the water line, which was not the case. It was just a temporary thing to see if it worked. Actually, this is a picture of the water line that's connected from the police station and town hall. So this is not the Poet system connection. But anyway, the pilot test did show that it worked, but I just have to do it in multiple passes. So there was something that worked, but you know, it wasn't. There was just some kinks that had to be done. And this is the system that was used at the landfill. And it was able to reduce the 1,4-dioxane to non-detect. Okay, so this is the water line. This is where the homes were hooked up. And we hooked up about 73 residents and then some with that had businesses as well. Believe it or not, there were some, there was really one or two residents that did not want to be hooked up. But for the most part, all the Parker Road was hooked up, and then a little bit of what's now called Route 24, used to be Route 513, and then Schoolhouse Lane, which is really the area that needed the water line, but no water company was going to put in a water line for just 12 homes. And then the residents on Parker Road were considered to be potentially affected, so we were able to put in a water line for them. To make this possible, it was a lot of coordination, a lot of informational meetings we had with the town, with the residents, the coordination to hook up to, first of all, just to get it in the roadway, and then to hook it up to their homes with something else. But everybody was very, very cooperative. One of the things that we did do was we were able to put in fire hydrants because there were no fire hydrants on Schoolhouse Lane or on Parker Road. And so when you put in a water line, that is a requirement to put in a fire hydrant. So we put in a fire hydrant every 500 feet. So that was good for the residents. I think it helped with their insurance rates. We paved the roads. Schoolhouse Lane did not have a paved road. Now they do. So I think for the most part, the residents were happy. So this is the aerial view on the left that just shows you. You can see the landfill here. And then this building here, which is the Career Coordination Building, is located here on Parker Road. This is the LV9 well house that's, I think it's up here. This is behind the municipality, the in Washington Township. I don't have a picture of the booster station, which was installed at the school. And then LV3 well house. We did some little perks, put up fencing, kind of fix it, because that was also contributing to the water line as well. These are pictures that I took as we're installing the water line of Parker Road. We try our best to not interrupt traffic as much as we could. And then this is a picture of when we were done. This is at Chester Town Hall. On the left is a picture of the mayor and the zoning officer. They were had this little ceremony for EPA because they were really grateful that we put this water line in. And on the right is a picture of our then, this is Walter Mugden. He was our then director of Superfunds, and now he's our deputy director of regional administrator. And of course, that's the mayor next to him. So again, they were just very, very appreciative that this water line went in. Okay, now we have to talk about the deep water aquifer study and what that means. So the OU1 remedy had consisted of the landfill property that's in the red, and the deep water aquifer study is what you see out here, the checker line out here is the study that Andrew and Andy will talk about in a little bit. So the remedial action objectives for OU1, the ROD amendment, is to limit migration of contaminated groundwater from the leachate from OU1 to OU2, enhance the treatment plant to reduce the concentration of morphodioxin, because again, the existing plant cannot handle the morphodioxin, so we have to upgrade it so it can. And then to reduce the toxicity, mobility, and volume of the contamination at the Northway cell and prevent exposure to contaminated water. And then for the OU2 interim remedy is to prevent current and future exposure to human receptors. So we had issued a ROD in 2018. So the OU1 ROD amendment, what we had selected was to upgrade the existing treatment system, put in new bedrock wells, and then for OU2 was to do long-term monitoring. However, we started design right after we issued that ROD. We started design in 2018, and we made some changes to design. So earlier last year, we had did some calculations and realized that it's actually cheaper, faster, more efficient to just demolish the existing treatment plant facility and just put in a new one. And then as I said, it's more cost efficient. And then we discovered that we didn't have to do additional work for the North Bay South area, so that activity doesn't need to be done. And so the estimated cost is about over $23 million. O&M cost should be a little bit lower, $847,000. And we are scheduled to have this design completed by the end of this month. And then after that, the Corps, after they, the Corps is going to be hired to conduct our activities. And we're hoping to break ground by the end of this year or maybe early next year. So we're moving along. And as I said earlier, it would be nice to finally have a construction completion on this job because it's just been a very long time since the beginning. So we're kind of nearing the finish line. And so with that, I'm going to hand this over to Andrew, and he's going to talk about the activities that were done.
All right. Well, thank you, Pam. So what I want to do here is kind of bridge the gap between where Patty ended off with the North Waste Cell excavation and where Pam just finished off there with the 2018 rod. I'm trying to request control of this slide here. If someone could please advance it for me, that'd be great. But HDR came back on the picture in 2010. Thank you. When we were brought on board to do the deep aquifer or the OU2 bedrock investigation, that process took us between 2010 and 2018 when the process was completed and the EPA issued the different remedy with the 2018 rod. And then in the last 2 years, we finished a PDI, and we're just finishing up the remedial investigation, as Pam said. So really, the events during this period can kind of simply be put, have been really driven by evolving technologies. For some reason, I can't take control of these slides. If someone could please advance it. There we go. So the way I look at it is you have the evolution of lab methods over this period of time from the 1980s, and really that evolution includes being able to see more contaminants and at even lower concentrations. So at our site, this created a big problem in the 2005-2006 range when 1,4-dioxane started to become detected in our groundwater samples. At this time, the remedy had been constructed, the landfill cap was in place. There was a shallow groundwater extraction system that was operating, sending water back to a treatment plant. But we knew from our 1980s investigations that there was waste buried directly on top of fractured rock and that this 1,4-dioxane contaminants was definitely getting into the bedrock aquifer as well. So we relied on geophysics in the evolution of that technology during the RI process and later during the PDI to delineate the contamination and then to design an extraction well network to remediate it. So it's really technology creating a problem and then technology solving the problem with geophysics. You can go to the next slide, please. So again, here are the evolving technologies I want to talk about. Take a little bit of time here. You can go to the next slide. So here's a kind of a cute, exaggerated depiction of how far technology's come. You know, in the 1980s, cutting-edge technology was this little handheld football video game. It's really just blips on a circuit board. And then in 2018, you can see at the bottom, it's like you're watching a high-definition broadcast. So obviously, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it kind of paints the same picture in laboratory testing. The technology just improved greatly over this period of time. And the impact it had on our site was that it changed the list of contaminants of concern as more and more contaminants were added to our list. 1,4-dioxane came on board in 2005 and really started driving the ship here as to where this site was going. More recently, in the remedial design, we started to investigate for PFAS. We did find some, as you'll see later, and we were able to incorporate that quickly into our treatment design. And then as Patty alluded to, with the nature of a landfill, especially with our waste cell, you don't know what what's going to pop up in the future. So hopefully we have some flexibility in the future to treat whatever contaminants pop up. But over the course of the investigation phase, you know, this evolution of lab testing has created some challenge that our team has managed. We've learned some lessons in this process. So, you know, the evolution of lab methods, keeping up with toxicity data, keeping up with changing regulatory standards, and managing that all in the course of an investigation does create some challenges for the team. If you can please progress to the next slide. So in the 1980s, as lab methods evolve, obviously, as I said, you're really looking at finding more contaminants at lower concentrations. Patty alluded to vinyl chloride back in the 80s. The method detection limit at the time was about 10 micrograms per liter. Right now, we're looking at 0.5 micrograms per liter as a reporting limit. So you can just see how that resolution has improved over time. Vinyl chloride is just an example, but you know it's a very similar improvement in resolution for all the other contaminants. But more importantly for our site is you have the addition of contaminants to the list. So in the 1980s, in the RI, I went back, they were doing priority pollutant lists. I counted the compounds and analytes that were actually analyzed for is about 45. Today, when you do the full TCL, the target compound, target analyte list, now you're looking at about 165 different compounds and metals that are being analyzed for. And the biggest difference in this case is that 1,4-dioxane isn't a priority pollutant list contaminant. It wasn't in the 80s, it still isn't now, but it's actually on the TCL list. So once 1,4 started to become analyzed for, you know, it kind of reared its ugly head and it became an issue. So kind of an interesting progression of 1,4-dioxane on the TCL. It actually started as on the volatile scan in kind of the earlier part of the 2000s. Our earliest samples were 2005. We started seeing detections. The reporting limits for 1,4-dioxane were about 20 micrograms per liter. And as you progress in 2014, 1,4-D was actually changed from a volatile on the TCL to a semi-volatile. And right now we're actually able to see with just even a normal semi-scan reporting limits down to about 2 micrograms per liter. Over the course of the RI, we actually did SIM analysis, which is selected ion monitoring. We got down to as low as 0.2 on the resolution for 1,4-D. So you can just see the progression over time for that. The state actually uses another method that was, it's really a drinking water method, but it's EPA method 522, and they're actually able to see as low as 0.07 micrograms per liter. So as I said, this addition of certain contaminants to what we're looking for has changed what the contaminants of concern are. And if you can progress to the next slide, you can see how 1,4-dioxane is now driving the car. And unfortunately for us, it's not going in a straight line. This is just kind of a funny depiction, but, you know, if you just keep driving straight, you're going to have normal system, post-remedy system operation. You know, the landfill cap's in place, the shallow groundwater extraction system's operating nicely, everything's good. But then once 1,4-dioxane takes the wheel and makes this hard right turn, now you're looking at extending the water line. You're doing this deep groundwater investigation, resulting in a new record of decision. You're designing that new remedy and eventually building a whole new treatment plant and a whole new system of extraction wells. So I don't think the detection of 1,4-D can really be understated here in the history of our site. Please go to the next slide. So one of the problems with a contaminant that's sort of emerging like 1,4-dioxane is that the standards are also changing kind of in real time as you're investigating. So when we started the RI, the state groundwater standard was actually 10 parts per billion, as you can see there. About the same time, later in 2010, the state, when they were looking at the potable wells around the landfill, they were looking at 3 parts per billion. So we started the field work for the RI in 2011. We worked with the EPA and their contract lab program to get as good a reporting limit for 1,4-D as we could. At the time, we were able to get 0.5. So between 2011 and 2015, when we were collecting the bulk of our data, we're getting reporting limits of 0.5, which we thought was good at the time. You know, we had the groundwater standard covered, at that concentration, at that reporting limit, we had the interim specific criterion of 3 covered. 2014, our risk assessors started using the 0.67, which was a tap water screening level. We even had that covered. So, you know, everything was good until 2015. Most of our data was collected. The state issued a draft interim specific groundwater criterion of 0.4, which was then promulgated as a standard in 2018, the same year we were submitting our RI. So you can see what a challenge that is. Besides groundwater, these other matrices, soil, surface water, and sediment, it's really hard to find standards for. Luckily, in the case of our site, since they were doing the North Waste Cell, they developed site-specific criteria. But for surface water and sediment, there's no state standards. We actually looked around the country. The best we could find was these ECO screening levels from EPA Region 5. Next slide, please. So the lessons learned with 1,4-D and sort of the moving target, we tried to incorporate with PFAS in the remedial design process. So when we started the PDI in really 2019, there had not been samples for PFAS analysis collected at the site. So we kind of worked quickly with EPA to get some sampling approved. And luckily we had the influent effluent from the treatment plant, which was a pretty good indication of what is at the site, as it's, you know, recovering shallow groundwater from the entire perimeter. So you can see the results listed below. They're listed with the 2020 standards that had been promulgated. But, you know, even in 2019, when there weren't standards, we could tell that we had, you know, not a huge issue with PFAS, but definitely we were above what we thought the standards would be. So we were able to work quickly with EPA to incorporate PFAS sampling into future phases of our PDI work. You know, all the well testing, but then also we did a full round of monitoring well sampling for it in 2020. And we were able to incorporate this into our design, you know, kind of in anticipation of these standards that we knew were coming. Next slide. So by getting ahead of it, PFAS, you know, we were able to handle it a little bit more smoothly. You know, since this is for the Philadelphia Post, I figured I'd give Villanova a little bit of love here. But, you know, this picture is just making a shot at the buzzer. And when we were at the buzzer for our submittals, the RI and the remedial design in 2020, you know, we had standards that were changing right at the last minute. So, you know, we did our best to adapt to it for the RI. For the remedial design, we were able to get ahead of it, you know, in the years that preceded it to handle it very smoothly. The neat thing about that picture is that there's 0.5 seconds on the clock. And 0.5 was our reporting limit throughout the RIFS for 1,4-D. So sort of the lessons learned here with the lab stuff is that as you're going, especially with emerging contaminants, you got to really keep an eye and keep up with some of the evolving research on these contaminants, including like proposed regulatory standard changes. Also work with your labs really to get the best reporting limits that you can, because you never know down the line, you know, what an impact that might have on your project. If you go to the next slide, please. So I want to move into geophysics here. So say I were to give you an assignment to sketch a house. But for this assignment, you had 10 seconds to do it. You were standing on a huge pile of garbage, and you had a bunch of angry residents screaming at you. And all you had was a blunt end of a crayon. You know, you gave me the house on top. It's probably pretty good, right? I mean, everyone can tell it's a house. It's got a roof. It's got the walls. It's got a floor and even a window. You know, there's nothing really wrong with that picture or that sketch. But then if I give you the benefit of having 10 years to do it in a climate-controlled environment, you know, with the latest software and technology, I'd expect something a little bit more like what's at the bottom there. And that's kind of how I view the geophysics. In the 1980s, they did some geophysical testing, but really their focus was on handling the big pile of garbage in front of them. Whereas when we came into the project, we had the benefit of having the site, at least the initial remedy implemented. We had time to really do some good geophysical work, and we took advantage of some of the changing technologies over that period of time too. So the impact of geophysics, you know, also can't be understated. We were able to identify where the bedrock was flowing through fractures with surface geophysics. We were able to drill wells in these fractures, sample them to delineate the extent of bedrock contamination, and then we're able to use it to design a network of extraction wells for the remedy. You can please go to the next slide. So this is the site conceptual model that was kind of slickly developed during the RI process, but the information from it is very similar to what they had determined in the 1980s. We have a little bit more ability now to make things look nice. But anyways, you have waste buried directly on the bedrock. You have near vertical fractures from that waste transporting contaminants into the bedrock aquifer, kind of radiating from the site in the northeast to southwest direction. And you have receptors down gradient in the form of these domestic supply wells that luckily have since been closed. But, you know, that's really the site conceptual model. If you can please go to the next slide. So in the 1980s, they did geophysics. They did surface geophysics to identify fracture locations. That's that first bullet, the electromagnetic terrain conductivity. They did downhole geophysics, and they did packer testing. And I have some few examples of their kind of deliverables mixed in throughout the next few sections here, so you can compare it to what we're able to produce now. In the 2020s or 2010s, we actually did surface geophysics in a two-step approach with resistivity and willow stick to identify the location of fractures. Once we identified those, we drilled boreholes into those fractures, and we tested them with a combination of downhole geophysics, some of the emerging flute technologies, and then we also did packer testing. Next slide, please. So to identify fracture locations, the first step is a resistivity survey. You can go to the next slide, please. Yeah, that one there. Thank you. So resistivity is actually short for electrical resistivity tomography. Basically, you have a line of evenly spaced electrodes. You apply an electric current to those electrodes, and then you take electric field potentials at the same electrodes. And when you process the data, you're left with a cross-section of the subsurface that looks a lot like this. This is a pretty neat one. You know, as you can see, kind of the purples and the blue colors are the conductive, more conductive portions, you know, relating to where there's groundwater. So this top part here above the dashed line is a saturated overburden. You can see the interface of the overburden with the less conductive greens being the bedrock. And these reds and the yellows are really the least conductive portions of the bedrock. And you can see subtle changes between the areas of lesser conductivity are related to fractures in the bedrock. This one's unique because, as you can see right in the middle, there's a huge blue section, which is pretty rare in these survey lines. Exactly. And that's a big fracture zone. Next slide. So with resistivity, you're left with results like this. On the left, you can see an aerial view of the site, and you have our transect lines spaced around the site. If you look to the right, that's a kind of a close-up of those, exactly, of those lines there. You get the pink lines are the locations of the fractures, with the blue lines being kind of the location, or sorry, the direction and the dip of those fractures. So it's a great tool to kind of quickly see where your fractures are, but you get only a clear picture directly underneath those lines. If you go to the next slide. So what we did to kind of flesh out that picture, go the other way, please. Exactly, it was a willow stick survey. So willow stick, instead of using electrical resistivity, is actually a magnetometric resistivity. Willow stick's a company out in Utah that developed coils capable of detecting small changes in magnetic fields. I guess typically these coils to detect such small changes would be the size of like a pickup truck, but Willistick developed these coils to fit in a small handheld instrument. Funny story, the guys in the field told me they actually developed it to locate gold deposits, but unfortunately for them, all they found was a bunch of water, but they adapted their strategy and found a market for it, and us geologists and us environmental guys. But the benefit of the willow stick is that you can get your results over a much broader area. So we use resistivity to kind of identify where the fractures, where we thought they were, and then we use the second step, willow stick, to get a more detailed picture of how the fractures were actually shaped. Next slide, please. Willow Stick we actually did during the RI phase to the north, and we did it during the PDI phase to the south. Unlike electrical resistivity, this only uses two electrodes. We used electrodes in monitoring wells mostly, but we also used some surface water bodies that we knew had connection to the bedrock aquifer. So the idea is you apply a current to these two electrodes. Electricity will flow through the conductive portions of the subsurface to complete the circuit. And then if you go around and you take magnetic field measurements with those little sticks at the bottom, the white part being where the coils are, you can detect where the electricity is flowing and correlate that to where the fractures are. The top picture is just a little Honda 2,000-watt generator and a little electrical controller. That's all they use to do it. If you go to the next slide, please. Here's sort of a schematic representation of that process. You know, you get the two yellow splotches on either side are the electrodes. You run a circuit wire sort of outside of your study area to your electric supply. When you turn the juice on, electricity will start flowing to complete the circuit in whatever fractures are available. And then what you would do with your instrument is you go around in a grid across that area collecting measurements to determine where actually that yellow line is traveling. If you can please progress. All right, so they look at the data very similarly to how the electrical resistivity folks do. The top is how the magnetic field would radiate between electrodes in a perfect environment, you know, very uniformly through the subsurface. If you look at the bottom, that's actually what's measured. And what they're looking for is difference between predicted and measured magnetic fields. And you can make inferences on where the flow paths are. Next slide, please. Again, here at the top is what's measured. Down below is that data just presented differently. And as you can see, the dark blues are the less conductive portions. The greens are the more conductive, and you can make inferences on where groundwater is flowing based on that data. Next slide, please. If you can play this animation. So if you asked a geophysicist in the 80s to animate their results, I don't know what they do, but they sure as heck wouldn't be able to do it. So this is actually looking at our RI surveys to the north. As you zoom in here, they highlight the power line, which is actually kind of a cause of interference for their technology and even other geophysics. The white cylinders are monitoring wells. And here you can see the black dots are the two survey areas. So you go around and you take a measurement at each one of those dots. And now you got the yellows and the oranges, the two different electrode configurations. And you see the circuit wires run some great distance. I think we had almost 3 miles of wire run to just get that wire outside of the survey area so it wouldn't interfere. And as I zoom in here, you can see a couple cross sections, but you can also see the actual magnetic field results. And as they're going to zoom in here on a couple cross sections, you can see the purples in this instance being the less conductive areas, the greens being the more conductive. And now they're making determinations as to where the water's flowing based on these cross sections. And as they zoom out, you'll see them start to piece these different slices together and connect the dots, so to speak. And this results in tracing a nice flow path away from your landfill in this case. So you can see here, you get the yellow lines corresponding to flow paths. So you can go to the next slide, please. So this next picture is actually kind of neat, because it shows the geophysics results overlaid each other. You have the resistivity lines on the edges there, and you got the willow stick, the oranges being the RI phase of the willow stick, and the yellows being the PDI phases. And you can see there's good agreement between them. You know, this biggest fracture right above the C1 and C2 line, it's kind of dashed on the resistivity line, corresponds nicely to our surface geophysics. So this really painted a great picture, next slide, of what was going on in the subsurface. And we used this data to drill monitoring wells. We also used it to drill wells that we tested during the PDI that later became extraction wells as part of our design. Unfortunately, this is a lesson I learned twice during both phases, but you don't want to do this in the summer. You can see the picture at the top. Trying to take measurements through this heavy brush is just miserable. And then actually the picture on the bottom, after Sandy knocked down, 100 pine trees right on top of each other and created a big rat's nest of branches and trunks that we had to climb through to take our measurements. It also has limitations based on man-made features like power lines, fences, buried utilities, in our case, buried waste. These are features that will kind of skew the results. The electricity, the current will flow through these items rather than the subsurface fractures and such. So it really works best in areas with limited population and limited development. We got lucky with our wire. We had like 3 miles of wire run down the street for probably a total of about 6 weeks, and we only had one minor issue with it when someone hit it with their lawnmower. Next slide. But in doing it in a more developed area, I think you'd struggle with that. So next, after we drilled wells and those fractures we identified, we did a bunch of downhole geophysics just to do some further investigation. One of the geophysics guys actually used an old ambulance to do their work out of. This picture also kind of shows you what happens when you do your surface geophysics in the summer. You end up drilling in the fall, and then you're stuck doing your testing in the winter. So, you know, you can see the heater they have, and you can see us doing packer testing in the snowstorm. Next slide, please. So downhole geophysics has come a long way, too, since the 80s. You know, back then they did sort of the basic suite that we still do now. You know, your gamma, your resistances, spontaneous potential, caliper, fluid temperature, and density. And you end up with nice logs like the left. But in the 2010s, we added heat pulse flow meter under both pumping and ambient conditions. Acoustical televiewer is the yellow and black on the right. And then if you go to the next slide, you see the optical televiewer in the middle there. You know, you get a real nice clear picture of the borehole. And these results, these are the 4 wells we did during the PDI. You know, you're able to see changes in the rock types right in your geophysical logs. You can see the fracture dip in directions. I mean, you could see that in the 80s too, but and then with the heat pulse flow meter, you're actually able to see how the water's flowing within your borehole. You know, fractures that are taking water, where the water's flowing up, where it's flowing down, and even make determinations on whether fractures are connected between boreholes. Next slide. So we use geophysics in conjunction with some of these flute technologies, namely the hydraulic profiling. So that uses a blank flute liner. It's basically just a big sock that you install in the well from top down. The real benefit is that you seal the borehole between testing phases, so you're not creating a vertical conduit like Patty was describing with the residential development. But what Flute realized is that when they put their liners in, they can take certain measurements, if you go to the next slide, and sort of determine the transmissivities of fractures. So the whole concept of Flute is that you install it from the top down, and it's installed just with the difference in head pressure inside the liner versus the head pressure of the formation. So if you keep the water level in the liner at least 10 feet above the water level of the formation, the liner will go in nicely. It will kind of unfold itself along the edge of the borehole and create a nice seal. What happens, though, is that it has to displace the water below it. So every time you seal a fracture off, now there's less space for that water to be displaced into. And the magnitude of that change that they can correlate to transmissivity. If you look down at this middle fracture here, the really prominent blue line, that's the transmissivity of that fracture, and that red line is the rate of installation. So you can see once that fracture is sealed, the rate of installation just really drops off to almost zero. So if you go to the next slide, please. So quickly, we used the downhole geophysical results with the flute profiling results to do packer testing to set those zones. We did packer testing to, you know, determine which fractures were contaminated, how much water was in each one, and make determinations on monitoring well construction and extraction well construction. So some of the monitoring wells, we used the flute multi-port systems. You can see that picture in the bottom. That's us sampling 3 zones at the same time. We did have some issues with flute, mostly because of our high bedrock aquifer levels. You know, we had some wells that were artesian, some that were within a few feet of the ground surface, so we had to install these standpipes on top to get the liners to avert, to overcome the formation pressure. We also had to install some of them with heavy mud and grout. So it was just a little bit of a complication. We had some complications with the flute sampling systems too that we've kind of worked around over time. But all in all, the profiling especially was a, I think, real benefit to our project here. If you please go to the next slide. So you can see where we came from in the 1980s. You know, we had some deeper, you know, probably more like a saprolite type idea of where contamination was, but no way did we have it delineated. Next slide. To a point here in 2018 when we had a nice clear picture of where the contamination was in the bedrock, where the water was flowing. 1,4-dioxane being having kind of the largest extent of contamination is the one we were highlighting here. So we've come a long way, mostly due to the geophysics. If you go to the next slide, please, you can see where we were in the 80s in terms of water level elevations. A lot of these elevations have, you know, kind of the flow directions have remained constant over time. If you go to the next slide, please, you can see how we use the shallow flow directions in conjunction with the location of these fractures to guide our extraction wells design. You can see a series of extraction wells that we included in our 2020 design so that we can pump water back to the landfill treatment plant, if you go to the next slide, for Mr. Watson to treat.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew, and I hope everyone's still tracking with us. So quick overview, Patty gave kind of the complicated landfilling history of the site. Pam took us through the regulatory, you know, hurdles of the site, how the site evolved over time. Andrew's discussion on the recent, particularly the recent RI techniques that we used was helpful, and it all culminates to this. So I'm going to talk about how we treat for emerging contaminants and then go through how we designed the treatment system and the lessons learned along the way. So, real quick, this is the existing system. So you'll notice there are a series of overburden extraction wells located around the landfill perimeter. They convey groundwater, extracted groundwater to the treatment system, and then discharge to surface water. One of the things we found out during the RI is that the upper reach of this river, which is called East Trout Brook, is actually a losing part of the stream, so that means it's feeding groundwater. I'll get into the treatment plant specifics in a moment. Okay, there, too far. So, important thing to note, the existing treatment system had a design flow rate of 120 gallons per minute, but really since startup, it's averaged about 70 GPM. And for what it's worth, the treatment system does actually treat all of the contaminants it was designed for. You know, there's typical landfill parameters such as ammonia, heavy metals, and various organic SVOCs and VOC constituents. It treats that. However, it does not treat for 1,4-dioxane. So the purpose of our design is to increase our overall pumping rate. So with the inclusion of bedrock groundwater, it's going to be substantially more than it currently is, as well as adding for 1,4-dioxane treatment. Here's a quick overview of what the treatment process flow diagram is. So the extracted groundwater is conveyed to an equalization tank. That's the picture in the lower left. The pH is adjusted, so the pH is raised, and the water goes through what's called an inclined plate clarifier. So basically we precipitate out the heavy metals and then they settle into this inclined plate clarifier, followed by biological treatment through a sequencing batch reactor. That's what the SBR is. Followed by sand filtration, carbon adsorption, and then surface water discharge. And the picture on the lower right shows the outfall. I should note that historically, 1,4-dioxane concentrations coming into the plant have been around 20 parts per billion, and they go out unchanged. So the influence 20 and the effluence 20, and that's been pretty steady throughout the life of the plant since they've been sampling for 1,4-dioxane. It's also important to note that there is no surface water standard for 1,4-dioxane at the moment, so that the plant's not actually exceeding any of their permits. However, as Andrew alluded to, keeping an eye on regulatory concerns and also groundwater concerns, that's why we're updating the treatment system. If you don't know much about 1,4-dioxane, here's a quick table of its properties. The biggest thing to note, I would say, would be that it's miscible in water. It really likes to be in water, and because of that, it's really difficult to get it out of water. So traditional environmental treatment technologies, carbon adsorption, so if you're not familiar with that, like your Brita filter, that doesn't work. Neither does air stripping. Also, Andrew noted on one of his slides that our 1,4-dioxane plume was the largest of our contaminants, and that makes sense because it essentially goes with water. There's very little retardation within the formation, so if any of you have 1,4-dioxane sites that you're working on, you wouldn't be surprised to know that that's probably your largest plume. A treatment goal to keep in mind is the New Jersey groundwater quality standard of 0.4. And since our involvement, or really since my involvement during the feasibility study, which I got involved in the site around 2015, that's been a treatment goal that I'll talk to more. So if 1,4-dioxane is difficult to treat by traditional means, what are the ways to treat it? I'm going to talk about three treatment classes, adsorption, biological treatment, and then advanced oxidation processes. I always like this quote from Edison, "I've not failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." In ideal situations and laboratory conditions, all of the technologies that I'm going to discuss have the ability to treat 1,4-dioxane. But as many of you know who've done bench and pilot study work, just because in theory it works in one situation doesn't mean it's going to be effective at your site or with, your circumstances. So here is a quick summary of all of the different pilot and bench work that we've done at the site dating back to 2012, studies by the state, followed by work that we did during our feasibility study, and then more recently our design. Starting off with adsorption, I mentioned that traditional carbon doesn't work, and it's evidenced by our lab data we've seen at the site. However, carbon does have adsorptive capacity for 1,4-dioxane under high concentrations and extended contact time. I'll get into that in a minute. But there is a synthetic resin that does work well with 1,4-dioxane, Ambersorb 563. It's a Dow product that was developed by a company called Emerging Compounds Treatment Technologies, ECT or ECT2. They currently do a lot of work in the PFAS space, and we had them out to do a pilot demonstration of Ambersorb at the site during our feasibility study. So back in 2017, They came out to the site, and we ran a pilot test concurrently with one of the many pump tests we did at the site at one of our more contaminated wells. Actually, it was our most contaminated well for 1,4-dioxane at the time. And we wanted to see how Ambersorb held up against the, the deeply impacted well. I think the concentration was around 350 parts per billion. And if, you know, if it could reliably treat to less than 0.4 microgram per liter. Additionally, we wanted to test, get a sense of what type of, operational issues we could expect, demonstrate their regeneration process. I should note that the Ambersorb media is regenerable in place, and that's actually the picture on the bottom right here is showing a one of the columns being regenerated in place. This is like a gray blanket that's insulating the carbon column because they use superheated steam to desorb the media or the material off of the media. So ultimately, we're very impressed with how the pilot study worked. Ambersorb did show great capacity for treatment of 1,4-dioxane because it's it's picking up all sorts of organic constituents. It's going to get its ability to treat for 1,4-dioxane along with other VOCs will be limited by what else is in your water. So basically, if the water is untreated, you're gonna have less of a treatment capacity before you're gonna need to regenerate. So we played around with the location of where in the treatment train we treated the water. First, we did raw influent, and then we also treated water after the sequencing batch reactor to see how it did when basically all the other organic constituents were stripped. We also did it at the effluent. So we did a number of different tests. Here is a quick schematic of an ideal treatment system with Ambersorb. It's a three media setup where you would have a lead vessel followed by a lag vessel and a vessel that would be in the standby position regeneration position. So as the lead vessel begins to see a contaminant breakthrough, that would be taken offline. The vessel that was in the lag position would be moved to the front, and the vessel that was in the regenerated position would be moved to the back. And as I mentioned, the media is regenerated. Is regenerated in place. However, one of the disadvantages of adsorption technologies is that it's non-destructive, meaning we generate a waste source that then has to be dealt with, in another matter. So something to keep in mind. The next study we did was a biological treatment evaluation. So currently, there's a few known 1,4-dioxane degraders, so some naturally occurring metabolic degraders that directly consume 1,4-dioxane. CD1190 and PHO6 are two of the more well-known ones. I guess I should say well-known in the bio community. And then there's some work being done out of NJIT by Dr. Menyon Lee's group, where they identified a nice co-metabolic degrader, DD4, so co-metabolic using another food source, in this case propane, to help accelerate the growth of DD4, which then degrades 1,4-dioxane. So we did a phase one study with NJIT, where we provided them four different samples from the site, so an influent, an effluent, and then from two different impacted monitoring wells at the site, and we wanted to see how DD4 stood up, how the mix of the two metabolic enzymes stood up. Then we did a control, and we did one where we just injected propane into the study. And what you'll notice, and what was interesting for our influent results, is that DD4 was yielded the best results, followed by the mix. But what was encouraging was that the propane in the control showed reduction, which indicates that somewhere in that mix of water is naturally occurring bacteria that have the capacity for 1,4-dioxin consumption. You can tell, looking at some of the other results, MW19, for instance, didn't show that, and there was some, there were some constituents present that were likely inhibiting, destruction of 1,4-dioxane. Unfortunately, due to the success of other treatment technologies that we're going to get into in a second, and the project timeline, we weren't able to advance the bio evaluation beyond a phase one study. But for those of you who have sites that really might be a good and would be a good candidate for in situ treatment, I think there is a lot to be looked at for using a 1,4 or using a bio method. So AOP, it's kind of a broad-based technology, but what I'm generally getting at is using chemistry or photochemistry to generate a hydroxyl radical, which is a strong radical that just indiscriminately targets its non-selective organic constituents, among them 1,4-dioxane. Some applications include using Fenton's chemistry, which is the addition of hydrogen peroxide and ferrous iron in a acidified solution, peroxide in UV light, peroxide in ozone, so Hypox, or UV light and using titanium dioxide. In 2012, prior to our involvement, the state did two AOP studies, one using titanium dioxide and UV light, the other using peroxide and ozone at the site to see how they would work. The original treatment goal was 3 parts per billion at the time, thinking back to how the groundwater standard in New Jersey has evolved. Unfortunately, neither of them were reliable to successfully reduce 1,4-dioxane. We continued on with our investigation. Should say, it's 2012 might not seem like a long time ago, but in the emerging contaminants world, I think a lot has continued to improve on technology. So it's not necessarily a slight against these particular companies. I think there's just been some improvements since then. Getting into Fenton, during our design investigation in 2019, we did a bench test where we used site water, both influent and effluent, and we varied the oxidant dosage and the contact times to see what could effectively treat 1,4-dioxane. Quick look at our data. The control was 25 ppb at 500 milligram per liter, and 30 minutes of contact time was the first time we had non-detect readings at 0.2 parts per billion. This is my only slide that really discusses money, but to put that ratio into perspective, if you had a maximum flow rate of 200 GPM, because at the time that's what we were thinking, and you had a concentration of 500 milligram per liter, or 0.05%, you're looking at $53,000 a month in operation costs, peroxide costs, basically. To put that into perspective, that was about five times the amount of the other technologies we were looking at. So I quickly ruled out fentanyl. Probably could have refined it to be a little bit less than that, but still that was pretty high. And that was from our effluent. So basically all of the other contaminants were stripped at that point, and that was just treating 1,4-dioxane. So not so good. So then we get to the peroxide and UV. So a couple things to note if you don't know anything about peroxide and UV treatment, differences in lamps. So the word low-pressure lamp versus medium pressure. Low pressure refers to a monochromatic lamp, meaning the setting is at a standard wavelength, in this case 254 nanometers, whereas a medium pressure lamp is a monochromatic or polychromatic wavelength, so it's over a certain range. Things to be concerned about is a UV transmittance, or UVT, that can change in the water based on, the water chemistry, clarity. Different parts of your treatment process might have better UVT than others, and that would have an impact on how well the system would perform. Peroxide dosage, all sorts of things we wanted to consider. What I liked about this technology is that there was a number of different vendors that we could look at and evaluate. And so we actually sent water to this company called Elanium. They did a low-pressure collimated beam study. I believe this is from our influent. They tested two different peroxide dosage and saw a nice reduction, followed by Calgon, which is a medium pressure. They again also received influent and effluent samples and saw okay reduction from different peroxide dosage. The blue line actually represented a spiked sample. That's why it's a bit higher. Ultimately, we decided to run a pilot study with Trojan UV. We did a one-month study, and the goal was to test water at the site at different locations and at different peroxide concentrations and see what kind of results we could get. So here's a small subset of the data we collected. On the left, we collected from the lamella clarifier effluent, so right after the metals have been stripped, and then on the below that was right after the sand filtration. We varied the flow rate between 5 and 10 GPM. We varied the peroxide dosage. You'll notice how UVT actually varied within our system. So following the clarifier, we were in the 60% range. Following the sand filtration, we were in the 80s and even low 90s. In all instances, we had pretty good reduction of 1,4-dioxane. So each color is a paired sample. So the influent followed by an effluent, you can see that in the sample name. Once we got to the post-sand filter samples, though, we really saw good consistent reduction below 0.4, and this is a small example of that where we're reducing it from 30 parts per billion down to non-detect or 0.2 or better. So we had some really good results in the study went well. Quick technology comparison, looking at all the different technologies, we were successful in all of them, but there's definitely pros and cons associated with each. I mentioned adsorption, a non-destructive technology, but it's very easy and reliable, and it was great to operate. Fenton's non-proprietary. Of all the ones, it really wasn't a proprietary technology. I suppose bio could have been as well, but the costs for operating were extremely high. AOP using UV and peroxide was the winner for us. It reliably met our treatment goals, and we felt comfortable going into design with that selection. So we go into design. Here's a rendering of our treatment plant that we designed. based on the hydro work that was done that Andrew hit on, we ultimately came up with a design flow rate of 450 GPM. The treatment system, we wanted to optimize to include not only 1,4-dioxane, but PFAS, which everyone knows about right now. That's a big buzzword in the environmental community. And we wanted to utilize existing infrastructure to the extent possible. To do that, we used some pretty cool design tools. One of the first things we did was we did a LIDAR scan of the existing facility and developed a 3D model to see, first off, if we could try and modify the existing site cost effectively to fit our needs with the new treatment processes as well as to accommodate the greater flow. Ultimately, we decided that building a new plant was the most efficient way to go. We sited it adjacent to the existing exterior tanks. It's shown in this black outline here. We still plan to use the same outfall structure, and we're actually planning on using one of these large SBR tanks as a new equalization tank, which will work well for our system. Here's a quick shot of the groundwater capture system and the extraction wells, which now notably includes bedrock wells. And here's our process flow diagram. It's pretty similar to the existing equalization followed by metals removal. We've removed the SBR, the biological treatment, because of the new water that we have coming in, the combination of overburden bedrock water. Typical landfill parameters aren't really seen at Combe. You know, we're not seeing high concentrations of ammonia, for instance. That's all very low. So really, this is, you know, there is some heavy metals, but really this is a 1,4-dioxane and some other, you know, organic treatment concerns. So we were able to remove the SBR. We go right into sand filtration, followed by an AOP system, and then activated carbon, a lead lag system, before discharge to surface water. Here's a quick show of the treatment plant floor. It's a pretty streamlined layout. Metals removal, sand, UV reactor, and carbon. So important takeaways, you know, Andrew already mentioned the importance of just reading the available literature, be it from the regulatory standpoint or just available technology vendors. If you're looking to retrofit a site, go to the site, take pictures, take notes. If you're looking to build a new plant, you know, try and go to something similar. Ask a bunch of questions specifically of the technical vendors. You know, my background, I'm not, you know, 5 years ago, I was not a 1,4-dioxane specialist, so I'm truly indebted to the various vendors that I've spoken with and, you know, attending webinars like this. It's so helpful to learn about these things and really get up to speed. The biggest thing I could say is talk to the operator. That, you know, if you're an engineer and you're designing a treatment plant, a good operator is worth their weight in gold, and they're often very willing to help you get the best design possible. Because ultimately, if there's a bad design, they're the ones that are going to have to, you know, work with it, not you. So they want the best outcome. Quick look at these pictures. When I was doing the pilot study, the AOP pilot study this past spring, you know, I thought I had a good relationship with the operators, but then all of a sudden I noticed the ground started being flooded out, and you could see all this sludge sediment just flooding our area. So I was like, geez, maybe this is like a little hazing, or I've overstayed my welcome. Turns out the operator actually tripped over a pipe the connected from the sludge storage tank to sludge pumps. And unfortunately, in the design, there wasn't a shutoff valve located right there. So basically, once he broke it, you know, we were already in it. Basically, just, you know, there was no shutoff valve, so we just had to wait until a couple thousand gallons of water and sludge emptied out. Won't make the same mistake twice. They repaired it and put a nice valve, as you can see in the bottom left. And that was a great teachable moment for me, because fast forward a couple months and I'm doing a process flow diagram, you can bet the first valve I located on the new design was right at the bottom of the sludge tank. So it's a good little anecdote. So what's changed over time? We beat it to death, the COCs. The treatment technology, the containment strategy for the site. You know, the site originally relied solely on overburden, and now the future design is going to be primarily bedrock. The high-res resolution investigation technologies. And what's changed, or what's stayed the same? Ultimately, the CSM has been pretty consistent. Some of the tried and true methods have still held up. Unfortunately, these things do take a lengthy amount of time, and the more stakeholders you have, the more complex your situation is. So, I think we're moving on to the finish line, but it's still, you know, it's still probably the beginning of the finish. And with that, we'd like to ask or answer any questions you may have. I apologize, we're a little over time, but. But we'd love to see if there's any questions.
All right. Thank you so very much. I'll let the audience know that we'll stay on just a few moments longer to go through some of the questions that came in earlier. But if you have questions, you can type them into that Q&A window in the lower right corner. If you are unable to stay with us and need to hop off, please know we'll continue recording things today so that you can access an on-demand version and replay anything that you may have missed. So I'm going to start and just share a comment. I received a number of messages from people who were really impressed and appreciative of some of the graphics that you were able to use in today's presentation, just the fact that you were able to catalog a number of things that you were finding in the landfill, and that it really just added something else to their understanding. So I wanted to be sure to share that feedback from the audience. We did have some questions here about the 1,4-dioxane and just questions about how far it may have moved in the groundwater plume.
Yeah, we had a slide. It was actually one of the last ones Andrew presented that had it roughly delineated to 0.4, the New Jersey standard. Patty, or Andrew, do you have off the top of your head distance?
Yeah, the figure shows it going from the site up towards kind of the schoolhouse lane, which is the small street that kind of juts out to the north of the landfill. It's about a quarter mile, maybe a little bit more away. And then I'd say to the southwest, the contamination extends probably about the same distance. And then you get just a little bit, you know, much narrower from east to west, but really it's about a quarter mile northeast, a quarter mile southwest is kind of what we're looking at in terms of 1,4-D.
Okay. And then we also had a question about potable water. So this may be a good question for our Region 2 representative, Pamela. So the question was, what did the residents do for potable water from the 1980s until 2015?
Okay, so in the 90s, the homes that had contamination, especially in Schoolhouse Lane, they were retrofitted with POETs, point of entry treatment. So it's box that sort of treats the well water so that they would be able to drink it. And then we put in the water line. So really the main focus was really Schoolhouse Lane. So there were 32 homes that had the POET system up until we put in the water line system.
Okay. All right, thank you. And we also got another question on upscaling your system. So someone noted that upscaling the system from 5 to 10 GPM in the pilot test to a design flow rate of 450 GPM is a big jump. They were wondering if you foresee any potential issues in achieving your treatment goal from that full-scale system.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't. I guess I would answer this. So we just wrote the specification for what would be required of the vendor to provide. So it's going to be a performance based requirement for the one-sport axing system. So in that regard, the treatment goals are pretty established. I think for a lot of us in the environmental field, when we're talking about pump and treat systems, we're typically working with smaller flow rates. I think 450 GPM is one of the larger ones that I did, but by no means is 450 GPM a large treatment volume for a lot of other industries, for instance, wastewater, drinking water supply, industrial wastewater. 450 GPM is essentially one CSS, one cubic foot per second. So I think the fact that we're going to be using a performance-based specification and designed around these parameters, I'm not too concerned. To be honest, and the vendors will say this, and I don't know if it's just sort of their bravado, but they would argue that the pilot study is more for our need, and ultimately, when they do a design, it's sending them a water sample, and they'll make recommendations based on your water chemistry, what the size system would be. So to answer your question, no, I'm not concerned based on all that information that was considered.
Okay. And Pam, I think this question goes to you. There were a number of people who were asking some questions about the site and where it was located and where they can learn more about the project. Is there a website or an online repository where people can learn more about this particular site and project?
Yes, there is a, I can provide that later. There is a link to our database for this site. But if you don't want to wait, you can just Google Clumfield South, and then it'll lead you to the EPA page where there's some basic information on the site, and I think there's some documents that are attached to it. Plus, there's a repository in Chester. I probably don't want to go there. And EPA has EPA has a database. So, yes, we do.
Okay.
There is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And we'll be sure to work to post that link so that as part of the archive, people can access on our resources page for today's recorded webinar. All right, I know we are running a few moments past our scheduled end time, but I'm starting to get a number of thank you messages from the audience. People are just chiming in. They really appreciated the information and the expertise that you shared. A number of sports fans really loved some of the sports analogies, and again, that attention to detail and some of the graphics today really did help. And they just really appreciated this very broad, large picture review of this site. I wanted to echo their thanks for sharing your time and expertise. So with that, I think what we'll do, since we're past our scheduled end time, I'm going to go ahead and walk through just a few quick final reminders before we close things out today. And one of the very first things I want to do is thank all of the presenters and organizers who took time to share their expertise, put the materials together, work through some last-minute changes, and again, everybody's patience with that initial glitch we had with the audio today. I really appreciated your flexibility in sticking with us. If you're interested in sitting in on additional sessions, we continue to offer online training and information sessions, as well as other resources through the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN website. And I also send out a free monthly newsletter on the first of each month where we'll highlight webinars like this. Kate mentioned an ongoing webinar as part of this series. We'll be gathering again together later on for the next seminar in this series. So I'll be sending out links so that you can actually register and sign up for that one, because the next delivery is already open on Kluent, so you can sign up and join us next time. For those of you looking for copies of the slides, we've posted a PDF version available on that seminar homepage that you used when you checked in. We'll also be collecting any outstanding links or references that were mentioned today during Q&A, and we'll put them there. And then you can also find more information for our speakers and organizers on that homepage, and I will ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form. I have posted it in the Q&A window. There are links to these pages as well as the feedback form, because one of the big questions I get every day is if we offer certificates. And the answer is we do, but in order to receive a certificate, you need to participate in the event and then follow the link to the feedback form and make sure that you check the box at the bottom of that feedback form, certifying you were here for the entire delivery or you replayed the whole thing. And then when you submit your certificate, you should have access to a certificate, or pardon me, when you submit your feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate like this, which you can either download or print out for your own records. So simply fill out that form, check the box, and you can then download and print out your certificate for your own records. If you happen to join together in a group, each person can fill out that feedback form in the room. They don't have to be individual registrants, so whoever signed up, I just ask that you share the link to the feedback form with anybody who may have sat in, and they can get their own certificate to save for their own records. And Kate and I do read each and every one of those submissions, so we really do look forward to hearing your feedback, both in the way we delivered today's session technically, as well as the content that was covered. So as soon as the archive from today's session is available, you'll automatically get an email from me with a link and instructions on how to play it back.